The committee will come to order, and we have the minutes from the March 3rd meeting. Resident Kelly, do you want to move the minutes? Would you move the minutes from the March 3rd meeting? Resident Kelly? Yeah, all right, thank you. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of those, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are adopted. All right, well, we have two items on the agenda today, which are, I think are going to be very interesting, and I'm looking forward to. And our first, are we ready with the computer? Close enough to get started? All right. So the first speaker tonight, first testifier today, is Dr. Bruce Perry, who's going to talk about trauma on children and families, and we're really excited to have you here, so welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Can you all hear me? Or should I use my
microphone? Oh, hello. I have no recollection of those events. My name is Bruce Perry. I'm a child psychiatrist. I very much appreciate the opportunity to come and talk a little bit about some of our work. I understand that you are interested in post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is an area that my colleagues and I have done some work on in over the last, actually, multiple years. I'm not probably going to talk specifically about post-traumatic stress disorder, but what I would like to talk about is the relationship between certain early developmental experiences and the risk for subsequent development of emotional, social, and physical health problems later in life. I'm not sure. I think my computer is, like, frozen here. So while I'm tinkering with that, what I would like to say is I don't want to make this a boring lecture. What I would rather do is make a few points about the impact of developmental trauma and then open it up for questions, because I know that I'm probably of best use to you in actually answering questions you may have about some of these things. Let me just start, since I don't have my visuals, I'm going to have to be a little animated here. I think all of you know that we all have systems in our brain involved in mediating and modulating stress. This network of neurons allow us to basically process incoming information, sort it, make some sort of decision about its meaning, and then act on that information. And so our stress response systems are really not only involved in traumatic big things, but our stress response systems are involved in all aspects of monitoring and regulating both our brain functioning, but also the functioning of our body. So I think everybody in the room knows that you can be in a stressful situation where things are challenging and your heart rate will go up. I think some of you have probably before speech felt a little bit of your palms a little bit sweaty, maybe, like mine are currently. In fact, I think my heart rate has to be over 100 right now. You know, the thing that really makes me nervous is that you may find out I'm actually from North Dakota. So, how's your hockey team this year? Just a little humor. Oh, no, there goes my stress response. All right. So, and I apologize. My computer's I don't know why it's not responding, but I can do this without slides. So, when you are growing up, when you're developing, these systems in your brain are exquisitely sensitive to experience, and even more sensitive than when you're older. And the reason that is that so much of your brain develops early in life. You guys, I'm sure, have heard this multiple times, and if you look at the intrauterine development of the brain, there are periods in the third trimester, for example, where the growth is so explosive that 20,000 brand new neurons are born per second. And this is one of the reasons that intrauterine alcohol can cause such destruction, that it's a vulnerable period in the development and organization of the brain. So this vulnerability and this sort of explosive development continues after birth. There are other processes that are taking place that are involved in how neurons make connections, in how neurons specialize and become functional in a variety of capabilities. So, for example, speech and language. A little child growing up hears lots of words, lots of words, lots of words. By the time they get to be 2, 3, and 4, the vocabulary is proportional to the number of words that were spoken to them. So this malleability of the brain, this incredible plasticity of the brain, is something that I think all of us appreciate to some degree, and we know that it's the reason little kids are such wonderful sponges of what we say and what we do as they grow up. But the problem is that this unique malleability is now the same reason, the same physiological cause of vulnerability when a child is in an environment that's chaotic or traumatizing or threatening. So the very same sensitivity to experience that makes us acquire language very quickly is what makes us incredibly sensitive to traumatic experiences. So if you take a developing child and they are exposed to chaos, if they grow up in domestic violence, if they are the victim of sexual or physical abuse, if they have any number of developmental insults, the stress response systems in their brain are poorly organized and poorly regulated. And this has a lot of consequences. And that's kind of what I want to talk about. And, you know, if any of you are really interested in the biology of this, I'm happy to give you lots of references. But I think the most important thing for your purpose is that a child who grows up under these circumstances, a child with adverse childhood experiences, ends up being vulnerable. They're vulnerable to almost anything you can think of. They're vulnerable in ways that make it harder for them to learn in school. So they tend to fall behind in school. They tend to not achieve their full academic potential. They tend to drop out earlier. They tend to have more need for special education services. They tend to have more mental health problems. Some of these mental health problems are similar to the post-traumatic stress symptoms that you will hear about or already know about. Some of these symptoms can manifest in the way they form and maintain relationships. So they're not good at, you know, they have difficulty with peers, they have difficulty with employers. There's a whole range of brain-mediated problems. Now, those cause significant morbidity in our culture. The cost to society for paying for the mental health, special education costs of children who have been neglected, abused, and traumatized are huge. One cost, one outcome from developmental trauma that many of you may not be as aware of is that adverse childhood experiences and traumatic experiences literally also make a child and then an adult vulnerable to physical health problems. So there's a large study, some of you may be familiar with this, they're called the ACE studies, Adverse Childhood Experience Studies. This set of studies looked at a large population of adults and did a retrospective review of the relationship between their current functioning and their previous exposure to adverse childhood experiences. And what they found were odds ratios, which basically reflect increased risk. They found that there was increased risk for the development of heart disease, lung disease, GI problems, and literally all the 9 causes, major causes of death in adult life are increased between 3 and 12 times by virtue of having had adverse childhood experiences. And it's a dose effect. The more of these things you have, the more likely you are to be ill. So literally what happens with children who are maltreated, children who are abused and neglected, in early childhood, as they grow up, they consume more healthcare dollars. They get sick earlier, they have a higher probability for serious illness earlier, and they die earlier. your whole life curve is shifted. So this is a huge burden on our culture. If you look at, for example, the utilization of Medicaid dollars in a population, in a foster care population, it far exceeds the use of Medicaid dollars in the non-foster care population. They have higher rates of asthma, higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of diabetes. It's a big, big problem. And, you know, depending upon the lens through which you look at this issue, you can essentially look at the cost-benefit ratio of diverting children out of this bad pathway. And it's a very, very cost-effective to take children who've been traumatized and provide high-quality early intervention programs for these children. There are a couple examples. You've probably heard of the old home visitation program. You probably are aware of high-quality early child care models like the Abbott-Sedarian model. But when children who've been traumatized or maltreated, these high-risk children, are put in these settings, their outcomes are far better than children who don't have that benefit. And cost-benefit analysis, which I'm sure you're all aware of, some of it is done by, you know, the economists from the Federal Reserve here in Minneapolis, or I don't know exactly where it is, but it's just somewhere. So it's return on investment for these high-quality programs is, you know, it's pretty amazing. In some programs, it's up to $16 for every dollar invested. Now, the challenge, of course, for all of you is that may be well and good, but the outcome for an investment now, in many cases, isn't seen until much later in the life of a child. Now, I'm very well aware that the accountability outcome timeline for politicians is a lot shorter than the accountability outcome timeline for these children. But I can tell you that it is well worth an investment and serious consideration of how to develop and sustain high-quality programs for children. Young children who have been exposed to traumatic experiences, because if you have a program that diverts just a fraction of those children, the cost savings in 10 years and 20 years is probably staggering. And so, you know, I could go on and talk about various aspects of programs that might be worth thinking about to talk more about activities that different communities have tried to act on this information. But I think probably the smartest thing to do is just shut up and hear what you have to say and what you guys are struggling with. I mean, I know it's, you know, I just got done talking to people in the legislature in North Dakota a couple days ago. And, you know, in this day and age, the resources are scant and the demands are many. And part of your job, of course, is to try and figure out where to put some of these resources and where to put your time and effort and energy. And I can't claim to be able to help you in that rank ordering. But I do think that this is an area where serious consideration is not only useful for the present, but I really think that this is a great gift to the future of the people of Minnesota. So there's my two cents. It's my story. I'm sticking to it.
Questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Perry, would like to know a little bit about the age range and what you know about what's most effective, because I think so much of the early childhood discussion and early childhood education has been discussed sort of with a chasm in the middle. It's like targeted home visiting for new parents and response if problems are identified. And then it's the 3 to 5-year-olds preschool, and we kind of have this area in the middle where we pretty much leave families and the community to just muddle through. And does the research tend to show certain ages, developmental stages are better to invest in? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, when people do those analyses where they sort of look at return on investment by age, there is this graded decrease. In fact, I think that thing I handed out has a graph on the back that illustrates a curve, the curve of how it's very, very high early, and then it starts to go down, and you still can have impact on you know, children. You can have impact on adults. You can have impact on 90-year-old people. It's just that the ease with which you can influence somebody gets harder as you get older. So what I do know about engagement in high-risk families who have children between 6 months and 3 years old is that if you support those families in a way that's proactive, non-punitive, helps connect them to healthy people in the community, helps them get mobilized, because a lot of these mothers are very depressed, very disengaged, there may be services right in their community that they could take advantage of that would require no new funding, but they kind of need someone to help connect them. You know, that I haven't had time to talk about it, but one of the biggest and most important factors really in physical health is connectedness, being related, being in a healthy community, a healthy family, healthy community. And what we find is the risk for the children who have had traumatic experiences and their caregivers who've also very often had traumatic experiences, the risk goes way down for long-term problems if they can get connected into stable relational environments. And I think that one of the challenges we have in our culture is that, you know, we have a very mobile culture. We have people who are living away from their extended family. We have people who are not part of a community of faith. We have people who may be new immigrants to the country, people who are disconnected from their culture. You know, they may be in the Minneapolis from the reservation. I mean, all of these isolating experiences increase risk. So what we found is that when you take families like that that have young children and you find an experienced grandmother on the block who will sort of look in on them and they have other community resources where they get connected, they do much better. And again, it's not a linear relationship between age, but the general rule is the younger you can get them, the better the outcome.
Certainly.
First a comment and then a rather odd question. Our main areas in the legislature that cost money are the health, education, and I think maybe the third is public safety. And all of these are directly affected by what you said, the things that are set in play as small children relate to the physical health later, the achievement gap, which we try so hard to control in all kinds of ways that I think are absolutely ridiculous, are really based to the early years. Our prison inmates, 85% of our prison inmates were in the child protection system when they were young, abuse and neglect. So that's the comment that I have, how important this area is. The last 3 years of pregnancy, the last 3 months of pregnancy to the first 3 years of life are considered to be that just phenomenal growth period. And then the other comment is, somebody told me that Oprah, who I never see, had somebody on a little girl that had been raised in a closet, basically, on yesterday, I believe, and
I was on that show.
Oh, you were on that show. All right. So then you know about her. My understanding is that she was put in a foster home around age 7, and she's 9 now, and they're talking about how much growth and progress she has made. However, it saddens me to think that in the last 2 years, she has grown 2 years, basically.
Right.
So to make up for time, she'd have to grow a lot faster. So it's absolutely marvelous what this loving family is doing for her at the same time. There's only so, we say we have a plastic brain, but it does, I say you don't want to know the cost and time it would take to redeem the mistakes you make in the first 3 years.
Right. Well, and I think that's a, first of all, I have to say I'm happy to see people in positions of influence who understand those connections, because sometimes it's a little abstract, right, to tell somebody that, you know what, it really is, you know, criminal justice really is influenced by these early childhood experiences. And so I'm glad to see that. They really are very intimately interconnected. And your point about the number of years required to recapture lost potential, it is so challenging. I think everybody in this room probably knows someone or has heard a story of someone who's adopted a child from maybe an institutional setting, Eastern Europe or something. And you know, these are loving, caring, decent folks, but their children still struggled, even if they had just a year there. And the longer they're in these environments, the harder it is to catch them up. And I think that that's just a very simple lesson for us, that if we are wise enough to care for these children early, we will benefit by not having to pay for them later.
Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, some of my thinking, I think you're really touching on here, and that is, as we're talking about early childhood and where we can get the best effect for an investment that we might make, whether it be a state, county, or whomever, is a prevention versus treatment or recovery model. And it sounds like, because we only have limited monies, and often we see situations where trauma and abuse occur, and we want to fix that situation, and what I'm hearing is that sometimes that situation, the trauma has already occurred. And I guess I'm looking at, as we look at small resources and best investment, it sounds like really the early on, the home visits before trauma occurs, supporting families from the onset is probably the best use of our money, though of course none of us ever want to give up on any child or family that needs our help. But
well, that I mean, from a neurobiological perspective, that would probably be the best bang for the buck. But I would remind you, and this is something that the last thing I want to do is seem like I'm trying to preach to you all about this, but you are in this unique position as legislators. You're kind of inventing the future. I mean, that's what you do with law. You're inventing the way things are going to be. And it's primary therapeutic intervention is secondary prevention. These children who have been neglected and abused usually have been in that situation because their parents had unresolved trauma and have not been treated for whatever stuff they had. So the ideal would be to take a vulnerable mother to be and start to heal her, so that when she became a parent, she would be more effective in what she does. So I always get a little nervous about that either-or argument, because the truth is, if you look at this as a transgenerational process, they're so intimately intertwined that you really, you know, that's sort of Solomon's choice. It's a tough one.
President Liebman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Perry, thank you very much for being here today. And you know, it's I think it's interesting to all of us to hear from your perspective as a neuroscientist. I think there's not a lot new here for me. Okay, I think we, and probably for most of us, I think we kind of understand generally the issue. But what I'm kind of not getting, and I wonder if you can help us, is we really need to operationalize this. We're in this situation right now where we have this enormous budget deficit. And we know that we're going to have to make very difficult cuts in our budget. A lot of those cuts are going to come from Health and Human Services. I think we on this committee really want to figure out as quickly as we can, as best we can, what sort of a safety net must we have and can we provide for our citizens, okay, across all of them. And I think this idea that we want to, you know, provide for the future, I mean, I love the way you put that about kind of designing the future. You know, that's a very interesting way to think about this, and probably makes us all feel a little more nervous too. But, you know, I wonder if you can help us with that. I mean, what are you thinking about? I mean, just, you know, just tell us what you think we need to do. I mean, we can take it or not take the idea, but I just really want to know, what is it that we should be doing from your point of view?
There you go.
No, well, I actually, that is a great question, because I think one of the things that is a mistake in this whole field, our field, this early childhood field, is the idea that government is going to solve these problems. Government alone cannot solve these problems. You do not have the, I mean, no offense, but you don't have the time or expertise to come up with the plan. You have to depend upon your early childhood community in this state to work with you to mobilize the corporate sector, to bring in the broader public to get engaged in this process, to bring the philanthropic community together, parents exactly, and create some kind of long-term strategic plan. You know, the problem with what we ask you all to do is that we give you limited time, limited money, and ask you to solve all these damn problems. And what happens is you end up tinkering. You kind of do, well, this is kind of what we can do now. And you end up year after year after year getting these complex problems addressed with a little Band-Aid here and a little bit of thing here. And it doesn't work. Because I don't think government can solve this problem. I was just told that the early childhood community in Minnesota has been working on a business plan, and that the corporate, that the philanthropic community has stepped up to really help support this. What I would do if I was you is I would give them coercive money. I would basically say, here's something to ensure that the business sector ponies up, that the philanthropic sector stays involved, that the academic community is involved, to have an overarching plan. And that you are one of multiple partners in this process. But because of your mandate and the resources you can bring, you can provide some appropriate direction. And so that's kind of what I would recommend. And I'm not sure that's not very specific, actually, but I really do think that we as a broader early childhood advocacy community really have the obligation to provide for you a rational set of options that you can act on. And if you don't have those, it's really hard for you to do, as you say, kind of figure this out. And I can't really speak for that community. I know there are people here that are involved in that process. But I would push them to get moving on this process and provide you with something you can actually act on that is not just government. I mean, it would be a huge mistake to expect government to underwrite and or lead all aspects of this early childhood process and intervention model.
We're going to be able to make two more questions, because I know you have to be at another panel as well. Okay, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Perry, this is kind of a good segue into my question. Regarding education itself, I had the opportunity to listen to, a neonatal neurosurgeon from the University of Minnesota who was so convinced that, from an education standpoint, when we don't get the results we want, we just tend to throw more money at it, and we expect more results, as opposed to it's more about the model and his surrounding the Montessori approach of a very hands-on early childhood development, to the point where in our community we had grants, just like you were talking about grants, and now we're establishing a Montessori early childhood development class that will follow through. But did any of your research, do you have an opinion on that? And versus what of our models, it seems like we're following the same old education model that we've had for 150 years.
Yeah. Well, I do have a few ideas about that, and that a lot of the work that we do is about how the brain develops and how it changes. And one of the things that we know is that we have invented this world that we live in now that's way more complex than what our brain is sort of designed for. it's different. You know, for 99.9% of the time we've been on this planet, human beings have lived in multi-family, intergenerational groups, lots of continuous relational interactions. So when you're growing up, as a young child under the age of 6, there was a grandpa, an auntie, a cousin, and all these people who could play a healthy role in your development. And the model for learning was a lot like the Montessori or the Reggio model, you know, where there is more opportunity to kind of explore something, and then you're with children who are a little older, and you watch them, and then you practice with kids that are kind of at your age, and then you end up teaching younger children. So this continuous flow of interaction is something that's actually very, very useful for learning. And any of you, none of you are probably old, well, you might remember one-room classrooms, no offense, but, you know. But, you know, one-room classrooms were an example of an educational model that really worked. And I think that as we look at some of these models, it would be very useful to sort of look at what's worked in the past. And with regards to the early childhood issue, one of the most important things that's happened in the, that I've seen happen in some innovative approaches is to start to bring babies into educational environments. Not necessarily to educate the babies, but to help teach people about who aren't around babies anymore. I mean, you can grow up and never see young children. So you never have appropriate behavior modeled. You never have a chance to learn how to hold a child. You never learn some of these fundamentals that are important in healthy development. So when we create more developmentally heterogeneous models, we benefit. And we were talking earlier today about a really innovative utilization of space and funding to co-house elderly and childcare. So they're in the same space. And it's wonderful for, I mean, the elderly love having these little ones around, and the little ones love having somebody to rock them and interact with. And it's, you know, you can basically do all kinds of innovative things. San Diego County, for example, if you want to look at a model, they've got 6 or 7 intergenerational programs that have just really done a nice job with, you know, some of these things. So,
my daughter did that. We have one of those in my district. An intergenerational, the grandparents in the daycare with the baby, or the young kids. She wasn't a baby at the time, but
They're great.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
I think we need to wrap this piece up, but thank you so much for coming. And
thank
just
you.
A request, if you know, two of the things that this committee really focuses on is foster care and the Child Protective Service,
Child
Protection Services. So if you have anything that you think seems to be working, that you know of in other places and want to, I don't know, Senator Cascaden or whatever your contact would be, let us know. That would be really helpful.
Sure. I'd be happy to. We actually are actively involved in both of those issues in a couple of states, so
we'd
be happy to help.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you. So we are going to go on now to talk a little bit about trauma in a different context a little bit, which is our returning veterans. And I think we're going to start, though. I think Representative Rukavina wanted, I saw he was in, is he still in here?
Mm-hmm.
You want to just, you want to start and just kind of give a little, did you want to talk? I'll let you for, oh, all right. Well, if you want to say something for 3 minutes, that would be great.
I appreciate it. You know, I appreciate the fact that you're having the hearing on post-traumatic stress disorder, and I have been asked, a member, Mr. Chair, by a constituent of mine whose son came back from Iraq to and he had problems, and nobody really noticed it, and he ended up committing suicide. And she, along with a number of other parents, you know, have asked me to put in a bill to require, actually, that counseling go on for a year after active duty. But, you know, I've talked to the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Minnesota Guard, and they're a little reluctant to take that approach, but they agree with me that, you know, something has to be done, so I just kind of came to listen today. But, you know, I made a promise to my constituents, and somehow I want to keep it, and I'm looking for suggestions from whomever. I'm no expert at all, and I've never wanted to serve on anywhere near this committee. You've got real tough decisions to make, and you've always had them. And this is a really, you know, hard decision to make, too, for how you approach this. But
you know, you can't let people that are having problems just ignore them. And I know I've even had several constituents whose spouses have come back and they called me up. They're afraid that something's going to happen at home, and you know, like a time bomb ticking. So that's why I came. I just appreciate it. I've got a whole file on my constituent's son here, and he even was in the Virginia Quarterly Review, done by a professor at the University of Virginia, who's done some extensive research all over the country on this. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just here to listen to
it. Okay. Well, and this is one of those tricky issues that kind of cuts across committee jurisdictions, too, and so we're trying to figure out how best to think about it. Micah Turnett, is that right? Or you can correct me when you get to the table. Thank you for coming today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's Micah Turnett, Mr. Chairman. I just prepared this, so I'll read through it and try not to stumble over my words too much. Hopefully it's informative. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Micah Turnett. I'm a two-time Iraq veteran that performed convoy security operations as a gunner and team leader in and around Baghdad, Balad, Baquba, and Tikrit. In 2004, I was a student working on my BA in graphic design. I had 3 years of school completed with a decent GPA. During that time, I also was enlisted in the Army National Guard and working a part-time job. In the summer of 2004, I was put on standby activation for deployment to Iraq. In September of 2004, we began pre-mobilization training at Fort Dix, New Jersey. In pre-mobilization training, we received excellent training in operations pertaining to our mission. We trained extensively to make split-second decisions during periods of extreme danger and stress. We received thorough training on weapons and administering medical aid to those in need, as well as tactical movements and communication during these times of stress. In December, we flew to Kuwait and spent about 2 weeks there before going to Iraq. While in Iraq, we were usually operating on little to no sleep due to the number of service members capable of performing combat operations on our base. Due to this shortage, we had to adapt and make do with what we had. During the course of my deployment, I was exposed to the types of situations one would expect in a war zone. IEDs, otherwise known as improvised explosive devices, roadside bombs, VBIEDs, the vehicular borne improvised explosive devices, car bombs, small arms fire, machine guns, personal weapons, as well as mortar fire, indirect fire dropping on the base. They were all some of the threats encountered during my tours. I was in country for a year before returning home from my first tour. After returning from my first tour, I felt extremely alienated from family and friends. I didn't feel like I could talk to them about certain events that took place in Iraq. It was similar in nature to how I'd write home about what was happening in our area. We may have been hit by an IED, shot at, or lost a team member, but when I was riding home, my family thought I was poolside with a cold soda in hand and a plate of barbecue ribs waiting for me. I still feel that there are some events that don't need to be talked about around those who have not experienced it. There's a certain moral perspective that one has to have in order to perform some of the actions in wartime. And unless you've been there, you can't understand what emotions and feelings arise around these types of situations. About 6 months after my return from my first tour, I was feeling as if I wasn't going to change back to whom I was. I still felt like I was moving at an incredible speed, but everything around me seemed to be moving really slowly. Although I felt like I had energy to burn, I was feeling down and disconnected from everyone around me. It was then that I decided to volunteer to return to Iraq. I returned to Baghdad 7 months after I returned from my first deployment. When my boots hit ground in Baghdad, I actually felt relieved. It was as if I had returned home. I think this feeling came because I hadn't reintegrated after my first deployment. Since I was still in the combat mindset, it seemed normal to be in Iraq. During the course of my second tour, I began to realize I was becoming something I didn't want to be. I felt like I was a shell of a person with little or no emotion performing my duty similar to that of a machine. It got to where I would see a dead body or hear about someone else dying, and I would carry on as if nothing happened, because as long as it wasn't me, it didn't matter. It got to be where I didn't like to be around others unless they had on the uniform, because you could never trust anyone except your brothers in arms. When I returned from my second tour, concerned family and friends approached me about my newfound lifestyle. I was filling my daily activities with reckless behavior that was endangering myself as well as those around me. I bought a motorcycle and used it to get a rush by speeding. I was also getting into physical altercations with those around me over pity debates. It wasn't even 2 months after my second tour, and I was already planning on going on another. I didn't realize it then, but looking back now, I feel I know what I was thinking. The main reason I wanted to return because I felt like Iraq was a place that I was meant to be. It was difficult for me to return to my college life after running combat operations for so long. I felt like those around me didn't see the big picture, the real world. It didn't feel like I was communicating on the same level. It wasn't too long ago that I was sitting at my kitchen table studying for class and heard the sound of a helicopter fly over. Without notice, I was immersed into an experience that seemed to take precedence over everything else around me. My pulse began to rise, and memories of medevacs began racing through my mind. Medevacs were when we called in air support for medical attention on injured service members or civilians. I immediately felt as if my chest was weighted down, and as much as I wanted to stop thinking about the events that had happened, they kept racing. However, through administering what I had learned through the veteran support network, such as breathing techniques and actually knowing what was happening with me, I was able to progress through the experience. Looking over the last 2 years that I've been home from Iraq has been motivational for me. A year and a half ago, when I saw garbage on the sides of the road, my pulse would rise and I felt like I had to change lanes, fearing an IED may blow up. Now when I see something on the side of the road, I tend not to have any reaction whatsoever. The large groups are still somewhat of a problem, but it's not so much anxiety that I can't handle it. Gaining the basic knowledge about how training can affect chemicals in your body helped me in understanding why I felt the way I did. It also made me more confident that over time I could make positive changes in my conditioning to lessen the severity of my anxiety. Throughout the course of a day, I have realized there are many things that were tough to get back in the flow of. For a while, everything from my own shopping to going through mail and paying bills was difficult. I had loud noises, anxiety from large groups of people, driving on public streets, holding a job, and sleeping problems, as well as a variety of other scenarios, and it makes for an unsettling reintegration. It wasn't until after my second deployment that I sought help for my troubles I was having, only doing so because a good friend of mine from my first deployment advised me to talk with someone at the VA center. Initially, I didn't get help because I don't think I really knew what was happening. It was a transformation that took place over a long period of time through intensive training as well as actual combat operations. It was the norm for me, but it was not the norm that I was used to. I was also apprehensive about what others in my unit would think of my leadership abilities if I were to mention I was having some problems with reintegration. So I chose the easiest solution, return to Iraq. I was already trained, so why not? However, the second tour only solidified my feelings of isolation from those around me. Now that I've been back for 2 years, I'm identifying all the trials and tribulations that I went through, and I'm learning new ways to cope with them, as well as how to be a productive civilian. It was a rocky road to recovery, but I feel that after receiving the support and tools necessary for the task, I have been able to make steps towards the future with a brighter outlook than I had a few years ago. By taking the initiative to participate in veteran support networks, I learned techniques to help me with the onset of anxiety. These learned skills have helped me reintegrate smoother than I could have without them. I'm currently a full-time student at the U of M, majoring in interpersonal communications with a minor in art. I've also been doing volunteer speaking through the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon campaign, speaking to service members about the potential issues with single soldier reintegration. In January, I was hired as a vet-to-vet coordinator at NAMI, Minnesota. I'm thoroughly excited to be in this position because I believe it is imperative to inform the soldiers of these potential reintegration problems so they can also adapt and overcome and live a productive lifestyle as a civilian. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for your time.
So, any questions? Members of Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your service and thank you for your powerful and very articulate testimony. I have a question, and this is an important discussion that we're having here today. The number of veterans that we lost from suicide surpassed the numbers that we lost in combat recently. Was there anything that you found that was helpful or any barriers for you in seeking help, the help that you needed?
Mr. Chairman, without a doubt, like I had mentioned, coming back, especially I had made the rank of sergeant during my first tour, and when you get into that
into that position, and it's a leadership position where those underneath you, they look up to you and they trust that you're going to make the judgment necessary. There's no way that I want to go and talk to somebody and let something leak out so that those that were supposed to respect me and trust my leadership abilities, if you tell them that you're having problems sleeping through an entire night or what have you, that it was frustrating because it made me feel like it might discredit my abilities. And as well as I know some officers that are, it's the same type of deal. There's the rank structure, depending on where they're at in the ranks and who they want to talk to, and as well as the paper trail. If you go in to the VA, that's where I eventually went into the VA and went through some stuff there, and it was very informative. And then I took some psychology at the U of M to get a better grasp of what exactly was happening and understand the medications more. But I'd say primarily it's just the stigma throughout the unit that you wouldn't want. It's almost like you kind of have that black mark once you mention anything about the problem. But within your own small social network, the few friends that you're very close with, you'd talk about it, we would talk about it, and it would kind of just be like, hey, are you having the same problems I am? And you'd find out that a majority of the people, I know from our unit, there's a higher percentage that we're having problems than that we're not, or that we're admitting it anyway.
Yes, thank you very much. I have a question. It's a little personal, so forgive me. If you don't want to answer, you don't have to. But I'm wondering how old you are and what the average age is of the group that you are with.
I actually just turned 27 on Monday, March 2nd. The first tour I was on, in 0405, I turned 21 the second month I was in country. And I had a couple of friends that were straight out of high school that were in my platoon. That to me is, I see them right now and they're still struggling. And even with, I think that's part of the reason that I've begun to focus on this area so much is that I had one of my friends before we deployed committed suicide. He hung himself in his barn after we were put on standby activation, and there could have been some outlying reasons. Alcohol, breaking up with his girlfriend, but he actually put on his dress uniform when he did it, so I have a feeling there might have been a lot more stuff going on that he just didn't talk about. But a lot of the younger guys, it was strange to see them coming straight out of high school, and they'd never, I had 3 years of college experience, so I kind of started to get an idea of, you know, what life was like outside high school and what the real world, so to speak, was. But these kids that were coming straight out of high school, and they went through basic training, and they actually caught them up to us when we were out at our pre-mode station. So from the age of 18 until they turned 20 almost, they were in combat training or combat, and they came back, and I watched it was more than just a handful of the younger guys. They spent all their money, or else they were broke because they married when they were really young, and then it didn't happen to work out. And so now they're just kind of, they're off the grid. I mean, a lot of guys are just laying low, and they actually don't talk about it because they don't want that stigma, or they don't want fingers pointing and that type of stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Resident Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again for sharing this with us and being willing to come here, and thank you for your service. I guess I just, as you're answering that other question, occurred to me, I think we were probably here listening to the previous presentation, right, when Dr. Perry was talking about the effect on young children of various kinds of trauma, and he was talking about how, the age and the stage that your brain is at is going to affect how you respond to trauma. And, obviously, we're talking about people that are at least post-high school age, but I just wondered if you have observed that the impact on people might be greater if they are younger in terms of being able to handle the trauma. I mean, I have kids that are, around in that age right now, and, I don't think of them as being completely adult people yet, you know, even though they're certainly very mature in some ways. But, you know, have you kind of observed that yourself, that maybe the younger soldiers or, you know, the younger folks are more impacted by some of what happens to them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee,
I'd say myself personally, I guess I might have actually been in that group. Like I mentioned, I was 21, 22 after my first tour, and I ended up, I think everybody's kind of in the same boat as far as we were all just trying to hold on and trying to get back to where we left off. And they just kept telling us, don't try to get back to who you were, accept who you are and move on. And I think that's about, I didn't really notice if anybody else was the age differences. I know there was older gentlemen, older enlisted and officers in our company that they had their own share of problems, and as well as the younger enlisted. And I guess I only heard about stuff that was at my pay grade or lower, so it was, you know.
And we need to thank you for coming down today.
Thank you for having me.
Ms. Rasmussen. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was actually just asked to do this a day or so ago, so I'm not even really sure. How much time do I have?
Oh, 8 or 10 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to do the best I can. Micah, thanks. It was great to hear your story. Brock told me all about you, so I was excited to hear. You don't have the little buzzers. I actually had the honor of briefing the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee this summer, and it was really cool, except they had that buzzer that they cut you off at a certain time.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm excited.
Okay.
I was actually looking for my notes, and I couldn't find them. Anyway, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Cindy Rasmussen. I'm a combat stress officer for the 80th RRC. I'm also a Army Reserve soldier who, like Micah, put down my job at the VA as a nurse practitioner and was mobilized, not deployed, to the United States to take care of soldiers and families' mental health issues. I'm a combat stress officer. And I was responsible for 26,000 soldiers and their families in 6 states, now 19 states. And I want to tell you that the program I'm a part of is the only one of its kind in the United States in the Army Reserve. And it was started 7 years ago by a Lieutenant Colonel social worker and a OT social worker. So what you're going to hear today is 6 years worth of awesome experiences. So quickly reading from Back from Baghdad, but still attacked by William Quinn. The only feeling I've ever had that was more surreal than arriving in a war zone was returning from one. Riding home that day with my parents, I felt nervous, too exposed in their Ford Taurus. There was no armor on the car and it felt light. At every red light and stop sign, I saw potential dangers everywhere. Even though I-94 heading into the city was nothing like Baghdad's airport road. There were no torch trucks or craters left by bomb blasts. The neatness of it all made me uncomfortable. Staying alive shouldn't be so easy. 2 years after Iraq, I have a different life as a college student, but some of those feelings are still with me. After a year in a conflict of such enormous complexity, I find college a bit mundane, and it's inexplicable to me that people here seem entirely untouched by the war. A quote from a reporter who was embedded in Iraq with a unit. The only place I felt real after getting home was in my nephew's sandbox out back of the house playing Army. I had the honor of participating in training 150 Military Order Purple Heart service officers. When I completed my briefing, which was about 2 hours, and I found a World War II vet up front with tears streaming down his face looking at me saying, "Ma'am, where were you when I came home?" was when I realized this isn't just about Iraq and Afghanistan. This is about wearing the uniform, and that's why I'm here. A young soldier put a handwritten note in my hand, and I went back to my room and read it, and it said, "Ma'am, for the last 3 years I've been treated for PTSD by doctors and nurses and others that have no clue over what is being a soldier and have this feeling inside. I can't thank you enough for coming in today. In the last 2 hours, you have done what nobody could have done. You make me feel normal again. That is a feeling that I thought I would never feel again since I was discharged from the Army. Again, thank you, and may God bless you. What I want to talk about today is not just PTSD. I know they asked me to talk about PTSD. You heard some about PTSD from the doc. And just to add on to that and to the question that you had, a lot of the folks that come into the military come in because they come to get out of a home environment where they don't have any future, where they've had a chaotic environment, where they've been sexually abused, domestically abused, whatever it might be. So as he talked about, you have these young kids coming in, and they're coming from these homes. And what I tell the soldiers and families when I brief them and try to prepare them when they leave and when they get back is, if your cup's already full when you come into the military and you go off to war, there's no room for anything else. And as a soldier, no matter what, you're going to have stress. As a human being in this day and age, you're going to have stress. You need room in the cup. So I just want to really briefly introduce you to what it's like being a service member. I'll give you an example. I went back to work a few days ago because I came off of active duty orders. I work at the VA. I ran into a police officer there who I had known about 5 years ago when I left there, and she said, "Oh, you're back. That's great. How's it going?" And she looked at me, and I said, "Well, it's not going real well." And she said, "I bet the hardest thing you had to do was figure out what to wear." And this was on Monday, and I said, "Funny thing, on Sunday on the way home from church, I said to my husband, I'm having a panic attack." And I really was, and if you know me, you know I don't have a panic attack. I have no clue what I'm going to wear tomorrow. Okay, so let's talk about who we are when we put the uniform on. We're mission-oriented. If you guys know, I don't even know, if you talked about missions, Micah talked about missions, we're mission-oriented. Nothing else matters. It doesn't matter. When I put this uniform on, when they call me and tell me I have to be somewhere, that's where I'm going to be. When they call me and tell me I have to be on a convoy, or I have to go here, or I agreed to come here, nothing else matters anymore. It doesn't matter what's happening with my family. It doesn't matter what's happening back home. We're mission-oriented. That is the way we're trained. The day we put these boots on, the day we put this uniform on, the day you raise your hand, nothing else matters anymore. We get home, we take the uniform off, guess what? How many people in the civilian world are mission-oriented? Do you know how many calls I get from older folks like me that have gone back to work and said, "You know what? I'm going to leave my job. I got fired. I got counseled." You have soldiers of high rank, of any rank, go back to their jobs, and they're getting counseled for being bad employees. Why is it? Because they're sitting in a room full of a bunch of people that don't think the way we do, that are not mission-oriented. They want to sit around and have task force meetings and talk about everything for weeks on end. Guess what? We don't play that way. We know the answer. We need to move on and get her done and move to the next mission. That's the way it is. So that's why, like Micah said, I didn't feel like I belonged. Guess why? Because where are all the mission-oriented people? Especially for Guards, member, and reservists. We come home, we take the uniform off, we hang it in the closet. We got to go back to a world full of civilians who don't get it. Number two, trust. You said it perfectly. Guess what we learned from day one? You don't trust anybody. You don't trust anybody except the person wearing the same color you are. When you come home, you take that off, that doesn't go away the next day when you walk in your door. My command sergeant major, who was in Iraq for a year at the prison, his son died in Iraq. And he comes and talks with folks sometimes, and what he says is, "I can't still go back to church all these years to pray for my son. Because I walk in church, what do I see?" What do you see when you walk in the door of the church? You see the backs of the heads of a bunch of people that you don't know. Think about that for a minute. Think about if you've been for a year or more in an environment where any one of those people is out to get you, they're out to kill you. You can't feel comfortable there. You can't go to the mall, right? Because guess what? What do? You know, I was at a gas station the other day and I saw a bumper sticker that said, "I'm a Vietnam vet and I'm damn proud of it." I watched them come out of the gas station. It was so typical. He comes out of the gas station, he backs up into his car, looks all around everywhere before he opens the door. This is a Vietnam vet I'm talking about. And then backs into the car. Because he had to make sure that everything was safe before he got in his car. Trust, huge issue. What about anger? Everybody knows about anger, right? Fight or flight response. When you're angry, it's that your blood pressure goes up, your pulse goes up, you know, you came here this morning, somebody cut you off on the freeway. You had that for 30, 50, 90 seconds, whatever it is, and then it's supposed to go away. That's how we're designed to work. Well, when you're a warrior, that fight or flight response, what does it do? Increases your blood pressure. Your muscles work better. Your eyes work better. Your hearing works better. Everything works better. We like it. We want it to stay that way. It makes me the best warrior I can be. Anything I have to do, I can do it when I'm angry and I'm under that fight or flight acute stress response. So we encourage it year in and year out when you're in the uniform. Guess what? That doesn't go away when you get home. Not only does it not go away, you don't want it to go away because you know that's how you save lives, that's how you accomplish the mission. So you actually feed it. He told you, I can tell you, there's a kid here in Minnesota that was at a briefing we did that has bought 5 crotch rockets in the last year and a half since he got back and has gone no less than 120 miles an hour on those crotch rockets and have crashed every single one of them and is here to tell about it. Well, after our briefing, he actually sold it. I was so happy and went to the VA to get help. But the bottom line is, we are an entity. We are a culture. You guys know about cultures, right? We're a culture within ourselves. When we come back and take off the uniform, we no longer fit into this culture. When people don't understand, and everyone in the U.S. is walking around being stupid because they don't get it anymore. So, the other thing I want to say is a doctor, Dr. Horzath, and if he was here, he would tell you he's a doc at the Cleveland VA. He's 60 years old. He went to Iraq 3 times for 3 months, came into my office, shut the door, got tears in his eyes, and said, you know, Cindy, I always listened to what you said, and I always knew that it happened, but, you know, I never thought it was going to happen to me. All the things you heard Micah say, that's combat stress stuff. That's not necessarily PTSD. We need to realize that everyone who puts this uniform on and learns what you need to learn to be a good soldier, to be a good warrior, and to accomplish the mission changes. And we need to accept that. We need to educate everyone so that when I go back to work at the VA and walk into a room and start crying for no reason, which happened last week, and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is actually happening to me too. But the bottom line is that that's what we need to do. And I just wanted to introduce you to that. I have brought some brochures that talk about the anger, the combat stress, coming home, what are the challenges, what can we do about it. And with that, I'm going to be quiet and answer your questions if you have any.
Okay. Thank you. Any, maybe one question the members have? Okay. Well, thank you. Oh, Representative Brown. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I just had a quick question related to one-size-fits-all efforts that oftentimes are what we do. And we try to accomplish things, but they are done in a way that doesn't necessarily recognize the individual circumstances that each person or each service member is both starting with and ending with. Do you have any thoughts related to how we target things in a way that works?
Well, I think what we're doing now with all the things we're doing, the Yellow Ribbon, with working together, the VA and the Vet Centers, we're doing a lot better now than we did a few years ago when we first started this program. I think there's certain things, one size, we're used to one size fits all in the military. I mean, I'm wearing men's shoes and I think they're a size 7, so we're kind of used to that. And the bottom line is doing something better than nothing. I think absolutely we need to increase the mental health resources. When I came off orders a week ago, I was the last person in the Army Reserve actively mobilized to do combat stress for soldiers. We have no other mental health providers in the Army Reserve doing what I did. So those are big issues. Does that help? Okay.
Well, thank you for coming today.
Oh, you're welcome.
It was really helpful.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Okay. We're going to now move on to an update on the MEDO program and what's been going on there. Dr. Sulik, I think. And so we have about 20 or so minutes, if maybe 10 minutes, to do your stuff. That would be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee, first of all, congratulations to you for hosting the testimony that you just did. That was really extraordinary. I think that for a quick update about what I intend to do, you have a handout that is much more thorough than what I'm going to go over with you today. As you know, that MEDO was brought into question, I think, over the last year due to reports of what certainly appears to be an excessive use of mechanical restraints at MEDO. And this is one of the first priorities that I took on when I came on.
Can you just say your name?
Sorry. Thank you. Dr. Sulik, Assistant Commissioner, Chemical and Mental Health Services for DHS. I apologize. The background here is that what I hope to do is paint the picture of who NIDO is, who they serve, and really what the vision is of how to be serving the patients at NIDO and the residents there. You all have heard me speak already many times, and you know that my background is as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, an adult psychiatrist, and a pediatrician. I have a lot of experience in thinking about limiting and completely doing away with the use of seclusion and restraint. At St. Cloud Hospital, I opened probably one of the first inpatient adolescent psychiatric units in the country to not use seclusion and to eliminate the use of mechanical restraints on the unit. And really how you go about doing that is the segue from what you just heard is really important, because all the evidence shows that if you have positive behavioral supports and trauma-focused care, regardless of the population, it really appears that you can be enormously successful. And with that said, I want to demonstrate to you that there have been some significant changes in the thinking and in the clinical programming at NIDO, and with a vision of trying to arrive at a restraint-free campus eventually. It can't happen immediately, but we already are moving in the direction of putting in the type of training and the type of support and the type of vision and direction for the staff that need to be that they need in order to provide the type of services for the patients there. So to start with, I want to define what NIDO is. It's a tertiary state-operated facility serving individuals with developmental disabilities with the highest level of behavioral dysregulation. These are the most complex patients with developmental disabilities, mental illness, and significant behavioral dysregulation to warrant a commitment to placement at NIDO. It is a locked residential treatment setting. It's not a locked inpatient psychiatric unit, and there's important differentiations there. Because one of the things that I will present to you is, as we look at what happened at NIDO with the use of restraints, what I saw is that there was really patients there historically were at a much higher level of acuity than really should have been there. And we needed to look at system issues and look at the array of services across state operated services that allow us to assess patients based on their acuity, based on the level of care needed in order to stabilize them and provide the safety that they require. And sometimes that's going to be better served at Anoka or at the Minnesota Security Hospital based on the level of acuity. So that thinking has already been put into place in the last couple of months. NIDO is currently a 48-bed facility comprised of four buildings that are split into two homes. Essentially, they're duplexes. And each one of those, each side of the duplex has six private bedrooms for the residents there. So you can see that the visual setting is very, very much set up like a residential home. Again, you can see already by looking at this that if you have somebody that's extraordinarily behaviorally dysregulated, that's very violent and very assaultive, managing those behaviors in this type of a setting is truly a challenge. NIDO residents have deficits that result in problems in many areas of daily living, and so there's a significant vocational rehabilitation program as part of being on that campus as well. Who has served at NIDO? There have been 300 admissions to NIDO during an 11-year period from July 1st, 1997 to February 28th, 2009. The male-to-female ratio is about 2.3 to 1. Average age of the residents there is 28.6. There's about 33% of the total admissions are minorities. There's a level of cognitive disability breakdown like this. 77% of the residents there meet criteria for mild mental retardation, a little over 15% for the moderately mental retardation level, and then 5% are not considered to be in the mental retardation level, and then 2.3% severely or profoundly mentally retarded. 95% have a comorbid mental illness, which is why they're there. 87% at the time of admission were on psychotropic medications. Most of the patients coming into NIDO who are on psychotropic medications are really on multiple medications, because there had been some pretty significant attempts at stabilizing them prior to their admission.
Reasons for referral to me, though, about 65% were due to significant physical aggression, 30% due to significant property destruction, 24% due to elopement. That means they were in some other type of setting, such as a group home setting, where they would not be compliant with a non-secured setting. There are significant self-injurious behaviors present, and about a fourth of them had criminal charges at the time of admission. Now, there's really four groups of residents, and when we looked at this, this is how they really panned out. And just to simplify for time, I'm going to move you to this slide.
Can I just ask one quick question, and I should know this maybe, but how do people get referred there? Is it through the criminal justice system, or is it some other determination?
Mr. Chair, it is a court order, okay. Usually commitment procedure.
So it's commitment, like as in St. Peter, with a similar process. Okay.
Correct. So there are really, when we looked at the residents who have been at NIDA, they break down into four groups. And these are well described and delineated in the four previous slides. But about 18% fall into what's defined as group one. And group one are individuals who set about 5% of the admissions over the time, really make up individuals who are not in the classification of developmental disabilities. These are individuals with profound behavioral dysregulation, physical aggression, have some social vulnerabilities due to other cognitive impairments, but they don't fit into a category of developmental disability. In other words, they don't have an IQ lower than 70. Group 2 and group 3 are individuals with either a mild level of developmental disability or a moderate level of developmental disability that are dually diagnosed with pretty significant mental illness and behavioral dysregulations as well. Those are the two groups that really appear to be most appropriate to be served in this type of a setting. Group 4 are individuals that are in the moderate to severe developmental disability level that do not seem to be appropriate to be managed in this type of a residential setting, mixed with patients with much more significant mental illness. And that's been part of the issue, too, is that the combining of patients that did not seem to be appropriately fitting in with one another. There's, as you can see from the pictures of one of the residences, there's some pretty significant environmental challenges to maintaining safety for individuals that are really not at a level of stability to be appropriately managed in this setting. So what that's leading to is the recognition that there really has needed to be a much more appropriate, stringent criteria about who's appropriate to be cared for in this type of a setting. And then looking at the patients that are in this type of setting, what's the type of programming and treatment planning that is required in order to be moving them to a much higher level of stability and improving their self-regulation so that they can transition back into a community-based level of care. More pictures just showing you the type of programming where patients are involved in numerous activities where certainly they have to, obviously, in order to benefit from the therapeutic programming in this type of a residential setting, they really have to be at a level of self-regulation where they can be safe in this type of a setting. There is certainly a continuous improvement project underway for me, though. This began long before my arrival. There was a lot of attention brought to MEDA in response to the recognition of the concerns around restraint use. The history there is that there was a period of time in which actual metal handcuffs were used as a part of the restraint that has been completely done away with. And in fact, since programming and since outside consultation was brought in, there was a plan put into place to really change the approach to seclusion and restraints on campus and to try to aggressively minimize them. That has been ramped up since my arrival. I've been up to NIDA several times already, and since I started in November, one of the things that we've really put into place is how do we get to be a restraint-free campus? What is necessary in order to get there? One of the first things we've done is to eliminate the programmatic use of restraints. So if I move you further on down to, let's see, I'm just trying to be quicker here than here. If I move you to this under objective number 3, reducing the use of restraints, there's two different types of ways that restraints were used on campus. One was programmatic. In other words, a patient has a behavioral dysregulation problem. The treatment plan says if this behavior is exhibited, then this is the intervention. And sometimes the intervention was programmed to be the use of restraint. That's something that the developmental disability field is really moving in congruency with the mental illness field, in that we really have done away, by and large, as much as possible with programmatic use of mechanical restraints. And really, the emergency use of mechanical restraints is something that you will continue to see in many settings. What has happened here is when the decision to eliminate the programmatic use of restraints on the campus was made, and when that was put into effect in September of 2008, you can see that there was a rise in emergency use, initially, of mechanical restraint use on the campus. I would absolutely expect that, because by no means have we gotten all the degree of training and support necessary to come up with different approaches to intervening with dysregulated individuals yet. But we're already starting to see some of the improvements. When you look at the total numbers, the value of observed number of restraints on the campus has decreased from September of 2008 at 33% to 16% for February 2009. So now that when I look at these numbers, I'm seeing a trend in the right direction, given some of the direction that's already been given for staff on the campus. I think that for the sake of time, I just want to I wanted to highlight essentially those key points, because there is a tremendous amount of information that was presented to you. There is a new clinical director on the Meadow campus. She and the overall forensics clinical director and the medical director for the State Operated Forensic Service and I have had numerous conversations already about where we really can change programming and lead to a change in three different types of specific clinical goals for the campus. One is to have trauma-focused care. Two is to have positive behavioral supports, which we know evidence-based practices demonstrate this with significant reduction in the use of seclusion and restraints if we're, particularly in the developmentally disabled population, if we're rewarding positive behaviors and not trying to punish negative behaviors. I mean, we all who have had kids know that that's the way that we've learned a lot about child rearing over the years as well. The third thing is setting a specific goal of the moving towards a restraint-free campus, which I really believe is possible. But I also have to have realistic expectations of all the things that are needed in order to get us there.
Just two quick questions. First is, what in terms of changing the folks that are the population mix, I guess. Do you have a timeline about how you get to just groups 2 and 3? And this related question, I guess, is do we have the capacity for 1 and 4 in other places in our system right now?
Mr. Sheriff, I'm going to bring us back to one slide, if I can find it in the midst of this, where we had the ICFMR beds, which are right now, the ICFMR beds are beds that are federally certified to be more appropriate for that group 4. And what has happened, we have intentionally, the decertification process for the 12 ICFMR beds on campus has intentionally started already. And there's been a MSOC program, that's the Minnesota State Operated Care, I can't even remember what the ADN acronym stands for anymore, somebody help me out. What is it, Mike?
Community Services,
thank you. There is a group home-like setting that has been opened up in Pillager where four of the patients already have been transferred out of. The idea is that model is working. That is a community-based residential model that we can see being much more effective than mixing those level 4 patients or group 4 patients with the rest of the patients in group 1 and group 2. And as far as the group 1 patient, part of that is really looking specifically at the criteria for admission at the time of the referral. And we are really specifically looking at how can we be triaging patients as they're coming towards Meadow. Is there a way for us to be triaging them to a more appropriate setting prior to them arriving at Meadow? If that isn't done at the time of arrival, then that assessment at the time of arrival needs to be done in such a way that we're able to take into account the acuity and complexity and the developmental disability level, so that within our system, we can place them more appropriately.
Okay. Thank you. I think we need to move on. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Ms. Oppheim, do you want to? Thank you for coming today. Welcome to the committee.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roberta Opheim, and I'm the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and it is our agency that issued the report in September of 2008 that brought attention to this issue. It arose out of complaints we received from individuals and family members about what was going on at the treatment program. Not only the use of mechanical restraints, but in addition, the height, including the metal handcuffs, the leg hobbles, basically four-point restraints on a programmatic basis rather than just an emergency basis. That report revealed a number of problems that I think concerned us, because we believed that a type of program like MEDO definitely needed to exist, but we wanted to be sure that it operated giving the highest level of quality of services that was possible. Since that time, and I think you have a copy of our conclusions and the original 13 recommendations, since that time we've continued to monitor the program, and we've conducted two relatively intensive site visits, one in October of 2008 and the second one just last week, so I don't have handouts because it's so recent that they aren't even done writing up their notes. During the first review, we were advised of a number of the steps that were going into place, that were planning for education for staff on therapeutic community intervention, a number of different plans that were in place. For some clients, there had been an immediate discontinuation of mechanical restraints. For others, the intent was to have all mechanical restraints discontinued by November. During our review, of course, what we wanted to monitor for then was, if you were going to suddenly and immediately discontinue mechanical restraints, what would be put in its place? What would be done? Was there a fear or a risk of increased chemical restraints or increase of inappropriate seclusion from the rest of the population, timeout room, that type of thing? We understand that there has to be a transition, but we were encouraged that they were starting to move in the right direction. However, the first review continued to raise some concerns in a couple of areas, and those included, they had discontinued restraints, but the program plans for the individual clients didn't reflect that. So there'd been no amendment to the plan, nothing to say what they were doing in place of it. The discontinuing of restraints was clear. However, the charting of incidents was there, but not what staff did as an alternative. And one that was particularly troubling at the time was an individual who had been routinely restrained. There was lots of behavioral incidents subsequent to that. They charted what the client did, including eating feces, but they didn't say what staff did about it. So nothing was charted as to what was the intervention. Did anybody try to stop, redirect, or include support? So the other concern we had at that time was we visited with some of the clients that were part of the initial report, some who had been extremely gregarious, outgoing, and they seemed to be withdrawn, trouble staying awake, and somewhat sedated. So those were areas of concern that we expressed to DHS and indicated that we would be continuing to monitor the ongoing progress. I have to say that in our review in February, I'm pleased to say that we've seen some significant improvement from our first site visit in October. The program plans are significantly better, including the behavioral interventions that are outlined, positive redirective programming that's there. they have discontinued the use of mechanical restraints, and in the rare emergency situation where an immediate intervention might be necessary, it is my understanding that they will use a manual restraint, which is always much more short-lived. They don't intervene for what I would call a normal, maybe exaggerated behavior dysregulation, but a normal emotional outburst, unless that outburst is going to lead to the person or someone else's harm. So if somebody yells or wants to throw a napkin or throw something, but they're not harming anyone, they kind of allow that emotion to dissipate and deal with it through the programming. There are a number of different things that we saw that we were very pleased with. There do still remain some areas of concern, and I have communicated, at least verbally at this point, with DHS what those concerns are so that there would be no surprises here today. And one of the concerns that remains for us is the charting still appears to be sporadic, inconsistent, and somewhat chaotic. We were looking over the medications in one of the charts between the med sheets, the chart notes, medical records, and it took us a half an hour to figure out what the current medical prescription regime was for that individual client because things were not done in an orderly manner. There was a variation in charting. Some units were much better at what they did to intervene. Other units still were charting the behavior, but not necessarily what intervention the staff did, which meant we saw a new and improved program, but we weren't able to track whether or not the staff were following it because there was no indication of what they were doing in these particular incidences. I think that's an element of staff training and development. I agree with Commissioner Sulik that these types of changes don't come overnight. They come over time, and I do want to indicate that there seems to be some indication that these changes are starting to progress. They have opened the Hillager site, which starts to develop the community capacity, but we remain concerned that whether it's DHS or the counties, that the capacity just is not there to develop to place people rather than having them come in the middle or allowing them to be discharged on a fairly quick basis back to the community, because I think we all agree that the minimum amount of time is the best scenario, and then return them back into the community. And we also worry about the community training and infrastructure that's out there so that facilities don't have to demit somebody. I know that DHS has beefed up their consultation to programs so that they can do it. I think we need a lot more of that. The main concern that remains, however, very serious for us is the use of medication. And I think the commissioner indicated that many of these individuals come in with an array of medications, multiple medications, and that's true. But what we saw was clients who were sometimes on 3 and 4 neuroleptics combined with 2 or more psychotropics and PRN IM injections of meds that might appear to be readily, easily used if someone thought they needed a chemical restraint. In one chart, we noticed that there was...
When you say chemical restraint, so that's something that affects the brain.
And the temperament and the aggression. In one case, there was a significant rise from the regime of meds in dosages from the November until now. So there was an increase in meds. In one chart of a client that was being discharged that day, there was no discharge summary. There were several warning letters from the manufacturer of the drug saying the lab results for this patient were problematic, warning signs for that particular medication side effects. There was no indication that a doctor had read that. I assume they had, but there was nothing in the chart that let me know who who was monitoring? Were they going to keep the med regime the same because of good professional medical judgment? Who was looking at that? And there were at least two, if not three, warning letters in there for that person that was being discharged that day without a clear indication of what the program plan at discharge was. You know, I'm not assuming that there wasn't one. I'm just saying that it was impossible to tell what that was. In another case, a client that had been at Meadow for some time and experienced a number of timeouts left the facility, and within a short period of time in the community placement had to be hospitalized for what the hospital described as toxic levels of Depakote that had accrued within the body. So those are some of the things that we will be continuing to discuss with DHS. Again, I understand that this is a process. I think that they truly are committed to making this change, but we will continue to provide feedback on that change during the process. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Thank you. And there's one. Representative Fitz has a question, then we're allowed to adjourn. But thank you for the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is on the staffing ratio of nurse to clients. And the administration of those psychotropic and the medications, are they administered by a licensed or registered nurse?
Ms. Hope.
Chair and Representative Frist, I think that that question probably is a better question for DHS. And right off the top of my head, I wouldn't be in a position. I know my staff have looked at the administration of the meds, the med sheets, the dosages. One indication that was particularly concerning to us, that as you look at quality indicators or quality assurance or statistical numbers, is we saw a huge weight gain over the last year in the population. And many of the neuroleptics are notorious in their, we had one where there was a weight gain of more than 40 pounds, others that were 20 pounds. So I'm not sure, but I would defer to DHS to answer the question about who's administering and monitoring the meds.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, through that, I just wanted to add that because of the charting, because the charting isn't lining up, as we nurses know, when you administer the medication, the follow-up is that within a certain length of time, you know, we do chart the change of the behavior and the adverse or good effects of that medication. So I'm wondering, is there some, I would like to know more about the staff and the ratio and who the staff are and the training that the staff has.
Well, and the department can maybe get some of that information.
All right.
Thank you. Okay.
I would just like everyone to take some time to read Just Plain Wrong. I was embarrassed to be a state representative when I heard the news reports on this because it felt like we went back 40 years. But you'll note in here that parents of people who were committed to here were retaliated against when they expressed any concern and were denied visitation rights. The only way you prevent this to happen is to have a lot of eyes and a lot of voices that are empowered to identify problems and see that they're corrected. The conclusions and the recommendations here really thwart some of the testimony we heard about how these people can be cared for. What the Ombudsman has found has been successful in other places. So since we didn't have time to respond, I would just really encourage people to make this part of your own personal public record because I think it's eye-opening.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we are adjourned.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.